Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. And our next running article is a short one. It's a time for a trail town trip. Three trail running havens where we're always glad we brought extra kicks. First is Boulder, Colorado. With more than 200 miles of trails around the Boulder area, it's no wonder this high-altitude town is home to hundreds of professional runners. Head to Chautauqua Park to pick up the popular Mesa Trail, which rolls for 7 miles through forested foothills in the shadow of Flatirons. Or test your lungs and quads on one of four routes to the summit of Mount San Ynez, all accessible right from town. With a short drive up Flagstaff Mountain, you can tackle the 8-mile loop at Walker Ranch, which crosses South Boulder Creek above and below a breathtaking waterfall. Roanoke, Virginia. Located on the edge of the Blue Ridge Mountains and minutes from some of the most scenic sections of the Appalachian Trail, Roanoke is an idyllic outdoor adventure and endurance mecca. Just 15 miles from downtown, you can run a 7.5-mile round-trip segment of the AT to McAfee Knob, an off-photographed flat-top ledge that offers panoramic views of the Catawba Valley. Aside from the Appalachian Trail, you'll find numerous trail systems in nearby, including Mill Mountain Park, adjacent to downtown, and Carvin's Cove Natural Reserve, about 10 minutes outside the city. The dense forested hills feel far from urban noise and bustle. And the last one is Lake Tahoe, California. A wide array of single track awaits runners in the Tahoe area, but nothing beats the 165-mile Tahoe Rim Trail, which circumnavigates the lake through areas like granite-filled Desolation Wilderness and the wildflower paradise of Page Meadows. Even on short segments like the 8.4 miles from Mount Rose to Tunnel Creek, you'll get stunning vistas of Lake Tahoe and continuous stretches of wild remote trails. If you're looking for a stout climb, consider the 6-mile round trip to Castle Peak's 9,000-foot summit, or stretch your legs on the 8-mile Rubicon Trail, which traverses the lake between Emerald Bay and DL Bliss State Park, with plenty of swimming holes along the way. And next we have, the price of outdoor gear is about to go way up. The U.S. recently imposed steep import duties on China and other countries where outdoor gear is made. Industry experts believe prices are about to shift. This is by Amelia Arvison. The bikes, backpacks, tents, and other outdoor gear on our wish list are about to get more expensive, a result of Americans' burgeoning trade war. That's the consensus of outdoor industry experts who spoke to Outside. As trade debate evolve and escalate on a daily basis, instability is the only constant right now in the outdoor industry. And sources told Outside that we are entering perhaps the most volatile and unpredictable period for business in recent memory. It's the only conversation that's going on right now in the industry, said Ian Comerford, the former CEO of Moose Jaw, who now works with many emerging outdoor brands through his company, Outsize Consulting. Nobody is thinking about anything but tariffs right now. On April 9th, the U.S. government imposed a series of tariffs on trade partners. Imports from all foreign countries are currently subject to a 10% baseline tariff. President Donald Trump also announced reciprocal tariffs on goods imported from 57 of the U.S. largest trade partners. Those include 49% tariffs on imports from Cambodia, 46% on Vietnam, and 32% on Taiwan, all of which are countries that produce goods or materials that American outdoor brands import. Then a few hours later, the president delayed the reciprocal tariffs until July 9th, but increased tariffs on Chinese goods, which now stand at 245%. Tariffs are taxes levied on goods imported from another country, paid to the home country's government by the importer. The Trump administration has said that the tariffs will level imbalances with countries who exact charges on American imports, as well as supposedly bring back domestic manufacturing. But some representatives from outdoor brands told Outside that this change will be impossible without added infrastructure due to the outdoor industry's reliance on imported goods and materials. Cassie Abel, the founder of women's technical apparel brand Wild Rye, tried to manufacture products in the U.S. and doing so almost killed her business. Delivery delays, poor communication, production flaws, and labor costs made it impossible to produce in the U.S. So she moved production to a factory in China that has a Vietnamese satellite. After growing the direct-to-consumer side of the brand by 75% over last year, announcing a rebrand and collaborating with Smith, the tariffs are overshadowing any wins. She and her team are trying to figure out how to reduce expenses because cash is about to become scarce. Brand leaders have been forced to become overnight experts in trade policy, an incredibly nuanced and complicated topic, says Jacqueline Levy, Senior Director of Advocacy and Government Affairs at Outdoor Industry Association, OAI. In a recent report, OAI found that 84% of member businesses surveyed said they will be impacted by new tariffs, resulting in millions of dollars in financial losses and affecting hundreds of outdoor products. For the past 2 weeks, outdoor industry professionals have been working around the clock, negotiating with manufacturing and retail partners to share some of the tax burden. Manufacturers from Asia who spoke to Outside at the Functional Fabric Fair in Portland, Oregon, said they also have little to no margins to absorb costs. It's a question of how do you spread the pain of that incremental tax, said Travis Campbell, the owner and CEO of Eagle Creek. In a letter to lawmakers, Campbell said Eagle Creek has an outstanding purchase order of $1.1 million on imported goods from Indonesia, which would normally accrue $260,000 in duties. With reciprocal tariffs, though, the company would have to pay a total of $840,000 in duties. Our business simply cannot afford this cost, Campbell wrote. Ultimately, as hard as business may try to avoid it, a portion of that cost will get passed on to their customers. Every source who spoke to Outside said that prices on outdoor products are inevitably going to rise, and in some cases, rise drastically. Even though we may see some brands and retailers shutter their doors, the big loser here is the consumer, said Matt Powell, a longtime outdoor industry data analyst and founder of Spurwink River Consulting. Prices are already on the rise. On April 16th, bike brand Specialized informed retailers that it will add a 10% surcharge for the new Turbo Levo 4 e-bike starting on May 1st. Missy Park, the founder of women's activewear brand Title IX, broke down the math in a recent Instagram video using a $100 pair of elasticized pants as an example. Before tariffs, the business made $2 in net profit on each pair. After the latest round of tariffs, the business now owes $20 to the government on each pair sold. You get the same pair of pants, Park says in the video. Right now, we really don't know if the prices are going to go up. But one thing you can count on is that we're scrambling to make the math work for you and for us and for our whole community of suppliers. Abel is in the same boat. She's still uncertain when and by how much Wild Rise prices will increase. There is no world in which we can afford to stay in business and not raise prices, she said. While some brands may increase prices immediately to soften some of the financial blow, others are waiting until final figures on tariffs stabilize. Comer Ford says one cost-saving option is to cut products that already have low margins. Another is to delay shipments from their overseas factories. Brands that overordered products during the pandemic in anticipation of high demand and finally sold through surplus inventory aren't necessarily excited to fill their shelves again. But if they don't expedite inventory from abroad, they may be left empty-handed. If you're managing a business here, the amount of uncertainty is just soul-crushing, Comer Ford said. It has paralyzed the industry. As of right now, Gloria Huang, founder and CEO of helmet maker Thousand, told factory partners to hold off making two entirely new products, a helmet and a bike lock. She says they've rarely raised prices in their decade in business, but have few options at the current tariff rate, which for Thousand ranges between 30% and 60%. When Huang spoke to us on April 7th, a shipping container of Thousand products was on the water, set to arrive at a U.S. port. Had the U.S. not delayed the reciprocal tariffs 2 days later, she would have had to pay an extra six figures in duties that she had not forecasted, she said. Those costs have the potential to ruin her business. Unfortunately, it's going to thin the herd, said Mike Lewis, CEO of Texas-based Bison Coolers, which manufactures domestically in Tennessee and Colorado and overseas in China. Any business that was in distress before you got to this point, they're going to go out of business because they're like, we can't compete. Already, the outdoor industry was experiencing hardship and recovering from the boom and bust repercussions from the pandemic. The turbulence has resulted in layoffs and staff downsizing, revenue shortfalls, product inventory imbalances, and snarled supply chains. Tariffs are their cherry on top of the teetering sundae. If there was ever an upside of the continued instability, it's that business leaders have learned to be nimble, said Steve Bick, CEO of and owner of Boundary Supply. The Travel Pack brand sources fabrics and other supplies in the U.S., but sends products to Cambodia for assembly. My gamble is that this will be resolved relatively shortly, he said. This is a temporary blip. Even if he's right, perhaps the worst impacts of the trade war are the uncertainty for long-term planning and the stunting of innovation. It's very hard to make any business decisions when policy continues to change month after month, Huang said. Lewis added, one bad decision or one calculated risk could really come back to haunt you. Whether the economy stabilizes soon or not, the damage to consumer confidence has already been done, Campbell says. They're either grabbing up items before prices go up and inventory wanes, or they're not buying anything at all, a fear of recession. It's going to be ugly for a while, Abel said. This is an article by Amelia Arvison, a journalist living in Portland, Oregon. In January 25, she wrote a feature story about the women's outdoor apparel brand Ewer and its founder, Mallory Otariano. And next we have, the feds had ordered national parks to remain open and accessible. Is that a good thing? Interior Secretary Douglas Burgum recently ordered national park sites to remain fully open. Proponent says it will speed up hiring, but critics worry it will increase danger. That's by Jamie Moy. America's 63 national parks and 433 National Park Service managed sites should remain fully open and accessible to visitors despite the recent staffing cuts, according to Interior Secretary Douglas Burgum's April 3rd order. Burgum's mandate includes another order. Before reducing operating hours or closing visitor services like trails and campgrounds, national parklands must first consult with the National Park Service Director and Assistant Secretary for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Parks. The statement has sparked a debate within the National Park Service and advocacy groups in its orbit. Proponents say that the order provides a roadmap for the Department of the Interior to ramp up staffing at the National Park Service sites so the general public can enjoy them. But critics say that the move forces understaffed parklands to proceed with services and open infrastructure despite a lack of manpower. The way it's written is hugely problematic, Kristen Bringle, Senior Vice President, National Parks Conservation Association, NPCA, told Outside. You can't wait for a political appointee in Washington, D.C. to get back to you on a closure you need to make right now. Bringle referenced Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, where the Kilauea volcano has been erupting on and off since December 2024. It's currently on again and spewing lava. Park superintendents need to be nimble in order to keep visitors safe, Bringle said. NPCA is one of several nonprofit organizations that have sounded the alarm about the feasibility of implementing the order. It sets up a situation that could be highly dangerous for park visitors, Bringle said. But Rachel Pawlitz, Public Affairs Chief for the National Park Service, told Outside that the order is a win for parks. It's not unusual for the staffing needs to fluctuate, she said. This order spells out a process that will allow us to coordinate closely with leadership in the Interior Department to meet the evolving needs of our visitors, adapting as needed to ensure visitor satisfaction. In Section 4 of the memo, Burgum orders the Interior Department to take action to ensure that the National Park Service is properly staffed to support the operating hours and needs of each park unit. Another group praising Burgum's order is American Bus Association, a trade group representing coach and tour bus companies. Overall, this action by the Department of the Interior underscores a commitment to keeping national parks open, accessible, and welcoming, the group wrote in a statement. For tour operators who rely on predictable access to National Park Service managed sites, the order offers much-needed clarity and assurance, ensuring their ability to deliver high-quality travel experiences in partnership with the nation's public lands. The order comes on the heels of a challenging 2 months for the National Park Service. Starting in February, the Trump administration began enacting mass layoffs, firings, and hiring freezes across the agency. More than 1,000 National Park Service employees were cut, and another 700 took buyouts. Since then, the National Park Service has been quietly hiring back some workers and also bringing on thousands of seasonal employees for the busy spring and summer months. Several National Park Service sites, including California's Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks and Yosemite National Park, have had to cancel programs and scale back on opening hours. Arches National Park in Utah closed a popular fiery furnace hiking area on March 23rd due to staffing shortages. A park spokesperson told Outside that the move to close Fiery Furnace was due to safety. The Fiery Furnace is a labyrinth, and one sprained ankle can trigger a rescue, Karen Henker, spokesperson for Arches National Park, said. And that's 5 hours and 10 staff people to carry someone out. Thursday, April 10th, Arches National Park announced on its website that Fiery Furnace would reopen to hikers on April 15th. Ranger guided tours will resume on May 4th. National Park Service Ranger, speaking anonymously to Outside, expressed concern that reopening some closed areas could damage the parks. Sure, we can keep everything open, he said, but who wants to recreate in a park with broken down facilities and no maintenance and no search and rescue? Bill Wade, the executive director of the Association of National Park Rangers, a nonprofit group that advocates for National Park Service employees, said the order puts park superintendents in a difficult situation. Under the Organic Act of 1916, National Park Service employees are to protect the nation's parks and monuments while also providing for public enjoyment now and for future generations. Wade, who is superintendent at Shenandoah National Park for 10 years, said the order places the needs of the public ahead of conserving park resources. The law gives priority to protecting the resources, so if you are a superintendent, you must be able to do this, even if you have limited resources. Before you put them towards keeping the trails open, keeping the visitor center open, keeping the public restrooms clean, those sort of things, Wade said. He added, I hate to say it, but I'm glad I'm not a superintendent right now. And our next article is, I thought I'd run far enough to win free burritos for a year. I was wrong. The writer explains how he is foiled by internet trickery during a month-long running contest to win free Chipotle. It's by Marley Dickinson. Winter in Toronto has a way of stripping the excitement out of life. The days are short, the conditions are frigid, and oftentimes I lack motivation to step outside to go shopping, let alone go for a jog. But when I heard that Chipotle's Xtrava City Challenge run event was headed to Toronto this past January, my motivation to get outdoors spiked. I got my running shoes out, I was prepared to suffer. For anyone unfamiliar with Chipotle City Challenge, it's a somewhat ridiculous but tempting ordeal for runners. The Mexican eatery gifts the runner who records the most laps around a specific Chipotle restaurant in a month's time free burritos for a year. You read that right. Free food for a year for any runner. This is like having an unlimited supply of gels at mile 20 of a marathon, except dressed in a foil with extra guac. I couldn't resist the prospect of free food. It seemed like the perfect antidote to winter blues and, of course, a fun way to kickstart my spring marathon training. At first, I approached the challenge with casual intention. I participated in Chipotle's kickoff event on January 2nd, where I ran a few laps around the location at the heart of the challenge, asking other runners how many laps they thought they could run during the month. During the first few days, I ran between 6 to 10 laps a day to keep things chill and scout out the segment in my competition. It was around day 5 of the challenge that my burrito campaign really kicked into overdrive. Running around Chipotle was no longer a joke. I mentally decided to absolutely shred the challenge into beef barbacoa. I quickly claimed the title of local legend on Strava, a designation given to the man or woman who completes the most recorded workouts on a stretch of road or trail. By mid-January, I was averaging 40-50 miles each week around the restaurant. Let me tell you, this was not an easy athletic feat. The Chipotle in question is located in the heart of Toronto, near the city's main train station. The sidewalks are slammed with pedestrian traffic at all hours of the day. The lap itself is a tight 1,000-foot city block. Every lap felt like a mind-numbing carousel ride through car exhaust and past bewildered pedestrians while inhaling burrito-scented air. Started my day with a morning run between 7 and 8 a.m. I'd return each evening to complete more laps between 5 and 7 p.m. By the final week of January, I logged around 400 laps around Chipotle, which equaled 150 miles. According to the data on Strava, I was comfortably in first place. In fact, I had a 150-lap lead on the second-place runner heading into January 31st. Victory seemed inevitable at this point. My girlfriend and I went to the Chipotle on the final day to snap some celebratory photos. I even made a homemade crown. But then, as the final hours ticked off, my victory fell apart. As it turns out, I was undone by cunning Strava trickery. Another runner, who I will title Mr. Tricky Tactics, outwitted me. Back on January 21st, this runner wrote on a Strava account that he was withdrawn from the Chipotle X Strava Challenge due to a hip injury. He posted the news alongside a photo of him receiving acupuncture on his hip. At that point, there were four serious contenders, myself included, who were vying for the title. We all thought the guy was done for, but he wasn't. In the final days of the challenge, he returned to Chipotle and ran hundreds of laps undercover. He waited to upload the data from those runs to Strava, so those of us who were following the leaderboard didn't know he was secretly amassing amazing mileage. He ran 110 miles in the final 10 days, even sprinting a personal best 15K split just a few hours after he announced his injury. We all learned about his impressive running feats when he uploaded his mileage from those 10 days to Strava in the final hours before the deadline. I was blindsided. I wondered how the heck he'd run so far. Considering I spent the last 3 days of the challenge running around that Chipotle, I couldn't fathom how I'd been outsmarted. During those last 10 days, I ran between 8 and 10 miles each day. I was there out there at dawn, running through snow and ice. I never saw the guy. The hard lesson I learned, I protested the result to Chipotle. The response was diplomatic but logical. He employed unique tactics. Technically legal, sure. Morally sound, up for debate. But their decision was final. My foe had employed unique tactics and, of course, ran more laps than I had. The free burritos weren't mine. They belonged to him. The hardest part was that I was so confident in my strategy, racked up a huge lead early in the month and to do anything to defend it. If I know my nemesis was still running, I believe I could have run big miles in the final few days to win. I would have gladly endured 24 hours of running if it meant scoring free burritos for a year. But hindsight is 20/20. Instead of earning a year's worth of guac, I instead learned a lesson in trust. Don't trust everything you read online, and always be prepared for some soul-crushing tactics when you're chasing a Strava challenge. Marley Dixon has been a staff writer for Canadian Running Magazine for 5 years. He has covered events ranging from Jamaica's Reggae Marathon to Paris Olympic Games. Beyond running, Marley is a diehard Toronto Blue Jays fan and shares his love for baseball on his website, Bluebird Talk. And next up, we have the top 9 small adventure towns in the U.S. These tiny hamlets with less than 6,000 locals provide the perfect blend of quaint vibes and outdoor fun. It's by Graham Averill. Bigger is not always better. While we spend plenty of time oohing and aahing over large mountain towns like Boulder or Chattanooga, there are dozens of smaller hamlets with fewer than 6,000 full-time residents that offer the right combo of amenities and quick access to some of the best spots for outdoor recreation in the country. Here are my favorite small adventure towns across the United States, from middle school hiking and climbing outposts to bustling ski towns. Bethel, Maine. Population 2,730. Why I love it? Bethel is the kind of town that makes you consider relocating. Tucked into the western Maine's lakes and mountains region, the village itself is super walkable with eclectic array of restaurants while being surrounded by public land from the peaks that make up the expansive White Mountain National Forest to less intimidating community forest trails accessed directly from town. The slow-moving Androscoggin River passes through the village, prime tubing in the summer, an ever-growing network of single track is attracting more and more mountain bikers. Oh, and Bethel is flanked by two ski resorts. Sunday River is the larger of the two, with more than 2,000 feet of vertical and 750 acres of terrain, not to mention a couple of heated lifts, while Mount Abraham, or Abraham, is the mom-and-pop ski hill we all wish we had in our backyard, with $39 lift tickets every day, friendly uphill policy, and a solid mix of terrain to keep it interesting. And has signature adventures. Most people come to Bethel to ski Sunday River. If you're looking for a challenge, head to Oz. A zone loaded with steep double black runs or Lake Lollapalooza to Blind Ambition, expansive gladed run on the edge of Jordan Bowl. Bring your mountain bike during the summer. Mount Abram has lift-served terrain, but you can hit a number of trails directly from the edge of town. Helix is a fun, flowy 3-mile loop in the center of the Bethel Village trails on the south side of the village. And where to eat? Mountain Social has a genius cocktail menu as well as a seafood chowder that hits it just right on a cold winter night. If you're looking for something more casual, Steam Mill Brewing has burgers and a rotating New England IPA on tap. And where to stay? The Bethel Resort will put you on the southern edge of the village within walking distance of restaurants and direct access to some of the town's most loved mountain bike trails. That's from $126 per night. Next town is Stowe, Vermont. Population 5,230 or 745. Why I love it? Quite simply, Stowe is the East Coast's best ski town, especially the winter at Stowe Mountain Resort, has enjoyed 329 inches of snow and counting at the time I'm writing this article, and then you have the New England charm of the village itself, with the steeples, covered bridges, and brick federal architectural style, and all this sits in the shadow of the massive Mount Mansfield State Forest and Smuggler's Notch State Park. Not cool enough yet? How about an aggressive and progressive local population that's worked to preserve more than 4,000 local acres for public use while building out a growing system of single-track and Nordic trails that can be accessed straight from town? Is Stowe still a sleepy hamlet tucked into the hills? Yes and no. The village still feels small, but it can be expensive and it can get crowded. But that's the proverbial price you pay for being the best ski town on the East Coast. Signature adventures in the winter? You're obviously skiing Stowe, which is one of the East's best resorts, with more than 2,000 vertical feet of drop and 653 skiable acres split between two mountains, Mount Mansfield and Spruce Peak. When the snow melts, combine a slice of the Long Trail and the Hazelton Trail for an 8-mile loop that climbs a 4,393-foot Mount Mansfield via a 2,000-foot climb that includes some ladders and scrambling before reaching the treeless summit, where you can see the surrounding Green Mountains and the White Mountains in New Hampshire. Mountain bikers should pedal the Stowe Recreation Trail, a 6-mile paved path along the Watt River, to access Katy Hill Forest. Stowe's signature trail network with 12 miles of purpose-built single track. Make sure you hit the mile-long Florence, considered by many, the best flow trail in the Northeast. And listen, everyone should make a point to visit Stowe during fall when the weather is crisp and the hardwoods are popping off in a barrage of reds, yellows, and golds. And where to eat? Doc Pond's is incredibly hip, incredibly good, and incredibly crowded. Get on the wait list, and when it's your chance, order the Vermont Cheddar Fritters and their Smash Burger and listen to the DJ spinning from a wall of vinyl. If you're in Vermont, you have to stop by the Alchemist and pick up a 4-pack of the beer that put the brewery on the map, Heady Topper. And where to stay? Stowe has resorts attached to the ski hill and quaint bed and breakfasts, but check out the new cabins and lodge rooms at Outbound Stowe, a few miles outside of town with direct access to Stowe's recreation path. The lodge has its own bar, pool, and hot tub, and a grassy lawn overlooking the west branch of the Little River from $150 per night. Next town is Silverton, Colorado. Population 713. Why I love it? Sitting at 9,300 feet in elevation, Silverton is a former gold and silver mining town that has found new life as a base camp for outdoor adventure, thanks to the surrounding San Juan Mountains, a hotbed of skiing in the winter and alpine adventure in the summer. If you're standing in downtown Silverton, you're within 15 miles of seven of Colorado's 14,000-foot summits. The entire town is a National Historic Landmark, with buildings erected in the late 1800s that still retain their Wild West vibe. Green Street, the main road through the heart of town, is the only paved street in the municipality. I visited Silverton during the winter on my way to ski the backcountry terrain in the San Juan Mountains, but I'm dying to get back in the summer and early fall to check out the growing network of mountain bike trails and see the aspens surrounding town turn gold. Signature adventures? Experience the best of the San Juans in summer by hiking the Highland Mary Lakes Trail, located in the Wiamuchi Wilderness of the San Juan National Forest. The 8-mile Outback Pass passes through the meadows packed with wildflowers before delivering to you to a trio of high alpine lakes that are known to house rainbow, cutthroat, and brook trout. The hike tops out at 12,000 feet in elevation, but you can climb higher by picking up the Continental Divide Trail above the lakes. The local bike club, the Silverton Single Track Society, is in the process of building out 30 miles of single track in a system called Baker's Park that you can pedal to from town. The first 6-mile loop has just opened, offering a steep climb before releasing you to a 1,000-foot flowy descent. If you have the skill set, I highly recommend skiing Silverton Mountain, which is like no other ski resort in the country. A single chairlift rises from a warming hut. From the top, you can skin onto a cornucopia of backcountry lines, all of which demand expert-level skiing. If that's not enough terrain, Silverton Mountain also offers hilly bumps from the top of the chairlift. Where to eat? Avalanche Brewing has great IPAs, as well as a full menu from cauliflower tacos to pizzas loaded with sausage and bacon. And where to stay? The Wyman Hotel has 15 modern rooms in a multi-story building that once housed a gas station, ballroom, and lodge hall. The hotel sits in the heart of downtown, and every booking comes with a $10 drink credit in the lobby bar. Private rooms from $176 per night, bunks in the Ted Bed bunk room from $75 a night. Next town is Highlands, North Carolina, population 1,110. Why we love it? Highlands, which is one of the highest incorporated towns east of the Mississippi, elevation 4,118 feet, has been a mountain escape since the late 1800s, originally attracting wealthy travelers who flocked to the village for its clean air and pristine surroundings. People today show up for the same reason, and Highlands has grown into a cultural hub of the mountains, with a surprisingly robust art and culinary scene given its small footprint. Main Street is bustling with shops, galleries, and restaurants, while the surrounding Nantahala National Forest offers fast access to hiking trails, mountain lakes, and waterfalls. Signature ventures are hiking Whiteside Mountain, a 4,903-foot peak, named after the sheer granite face that rises to its summit. It's a must-do venture close to town. The 2-mile Whiteside Mountain Trail forms a loop that delivers you to the edge of the 700-foot cliff, one of the tallest in the eastern U.S. You can actually drive your car behind Bridal Veil Falls, just outside of town, but for more adventurous waterfall, head to Bust Your Butt Falls, a swimming hole just off Highway 64 on the Coolahasa River with a jumping rock and natural water slide at the base of the falls. And where to eat? You can't turn around without stumbling into another fancy and pricey restaurant in Highlands. But I like Mountain Fresh Grocery for its go-to sandwiches and snacks that hit the spot on big hikes. Where to stay? Highlands has no shortage of high-end hotels and resorts, but I like the new Outpost Inn, a 14-room motel that was recently renovated into boutique stay, where each room has its own typewriter and turntable with record collection, and that's from $189 per night. Well, we're running out of time. We'll have to continue this next week, so stay tuned. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.